That's the Cannonball Adderley Quintet with Work Song from their 1960 album, Them Dirty Blues, which produced two jazz classics. This tune, Work Song, composed by Nat Adderley, who you'll be hearing on cornet, and Dat Dare by Bobby Timmons, who you'll be hearing on piano. Julian Cannonball Adderley, Nat's older brother, is on alto sax, Sam Jones on bass, Louis Hayes on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, February the 5th. And today, taking a cue from that song, we're talking about work. Specifically, about African Americans and work. We started the week with Jeffrey Perry delivering a lecture on the work of Theodore Allen, author of the two-volume series that we discussed on Monday, The Invention of the White Race. And he noted in his work that in 1619, when Africans first were brought to Virginia, having been captured, 20 of them, by Dutchmen from a Spanish slave ship, there were no white people there. There was an assortment of Europeans, English people, Scottish people, Irish people, Dutch people, German, but no whites. But there did come a time when there was an amalgamation of whites, whether they were servants or tenants or planters or merchants or craftsmen. They were all lumped together in one particular all-inclusive class called whites. And that began the social, political, and economic order, the defined economic order in the United States, using this social construct in a very political way called race. And that was what informed the so-called democracy that we hear so much about in the United States. I've described to you the meaning of democracy, which should be viewed as, in a sense, from the people's perspective, the quality and frequency of access that we enjoy or that we have to the strategic resources of our society. And one of those strategic resources is employment. And isn't it odd that the very people who were oppressed in this country to begin with, the very first groups, I'm referring to the First Nations people, and the millions of Africans, by estimation, as many as 20 million Africans, comprising the largest movement, forced movement of people across the Atlantic, to work the land. First, the land was taken from the First Nations, and then the Africans brought to work the land to produce wealth. And therefore, their labor was a strategic resource to those people who were busy constructing this new world predicated on the social construct of race. We are in luck today to have as our tour guide giving a presentation on work, employment, and African Americans from the turn of the Civil War to the turn of the 21st century. So we'll be talking toil and trouble today, black labor from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. Our guest, Dr. Charles L. Lumpkins, who will be putting into historical context one of the most vexing problems confronting African Americans today. And it's ironic. And that is unemployment. There was a time when there was no unemployment because there was slavery. His presentation, as I said, covers the period from colonial times at the eve of the Civil War to the turn of the 21st century, the beginnings of the so-called civil rights era. Dr. Lumpkins is a lecturer of labor and employment relations at Pennsylvania State University, where he earned both his master's degree and a doctorate in history. His scholastic research focuses on the history of African Americans, with particular interests relating to the history of social and political movements and the history of the working class. And it is a great joy to have you with us today, Dr. Lumpkins.
And a happy Thursday to you.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Well, this is a class.
I think you can hear me.
Yes, we can. This is a class,
And
we are your students, and we await your lecture, but could you give us a synopsis of where it is you're going to take us today?
Okay. What I actually planned is to start from the end of the Civil War, the beginning of Reconstruction, and I don't think I'll be able to cover or get up to the turn of the 21st century. In fact, I think I'll be fortunate to get as far as the New Deal, Great Depression, World War II era.
Well, here's what we'll do. Right away, we'll fix that. And it means that you will have to make another appearance to follow up to wherever it is you got to.
Okay. Well, yes. Why not? After all, that's what we're doing now in school, namely have courses in sequence. Yes. And I just want to add, I also teach the African American Experience, a history-oriented course for the Department of African American Studies here at the Pennsylvania State University. I got to, make everyone happy now as far as what I do. Yes.
All right. So recede into the wings of the curtains, and you will take the show.
All righty. Very good. One of the things I want to mention is that Jeff Perry, who was on your show on Monday talking about the invention of the white race, makes a good foundation for what I have to talk about for today. Although Jeff Perry talks about the development of race and racism and labor systems in general in colonial America, much of that continue on in one form or another into the 19th century. And this is where I'm going to pick up with Reconstruction. I just want to say one thing. I do teach the perspective that slavery was very pivotal, very crucial to the development of the United States. I'm trying to remember the name of the historian, but right now it doesn't come to my mind. But I remember him saying, using other people's sources, that only one thing was more valuable than slaves in the United States prior to the Civil War, and that was land. In terms of capital investment, slaves were second only to land. Everything else, factories, ships, whatever, all capital investments, did not equal the value of slaves. Now, with the end of the Civil War, the destruction of the institution of slavery, the South was basically left destitute, not only because of war, but capital in the form of human beings became free. Now, Reconstruction, whatever people think of Reconstruction, we have to remember that Reconstruction, first of all, took place in all parts of the United States. In the North, it meant disciplining industrial workers over the next 2-3 decades after the American Civil War. In the West, it meant suppressing Native American resistance, putting them onto reservations, and opening the West to industrial investments and exploitation of the environment. In the South, Well, that's where we normally think of Reconstruction, the southern states, the ex-Confederate states. And there, of course, it was very dramatic and involved, as I said, the destruction of a major labor system, which was also simultaneously a business system, an economic system. Now, of course, different historians have arguments. Was slavery capitalistic, or was it embedded within capitalism but not a capitalist labor system, so on and so forth? That's interesting debate, and I'll leave that open to callers or anyone else who wish to pursue that angle and question and answers. And I don't know how you want to do it, Eutrice, if you want to have questions and answers as I move along, or at the end. I'll leave that up to you.
At the end.
At the end. Okay, very good. Now, the thing with Reconstruction in the South is that the victorious North had to somehow teach ex-slaves and ex-slaveholders how to live in a capitalist economy, a capitalist market economy and a capitalist labor market, namely the labor market being that working people, wage earners, will sell their labor power to an employer in exchange for wages. Even though various Americans at that time call wage labor or wage work a form of wage slavery, unlike what I tell my students, chattel slavery, at least wage workers were not, let's say, compelled to work. But as the old joke, I think it was Karl Marx, but I don't know if it was him or attributed to him or someone else. The thing with wage labor is that, yes, you're free. And, of course, the classical definition is that wage workers were free to find an employer, free to sign a contract, and free to terminate employment, whereas slaves couldn't do that. But the joke is also free wage workers were free to starve. So that leads some people to say, in the final analysis, it is a form of slavery, wage slavery, because people were compelled to work in order to stay alive and have to work for someone else, which was opposite of the ideal at that time. We're talking 1860s, even into the 1880s, something that was left over from the colonial period. The ideal was to be economically independent as a self-employed person, whether you own a farm or whether you own a plantation, a workshop, a factory, or a ship, or a stagecoach, any type of property that will make an income, make a livelihood for the person, the owner of that property. Okay, well, the slaves, of course, the vast majority of them were penniless. They really had no ownership of capital. A few lucky individual ex-slaves, did have ownership, perhaps mainly from their slave masters. The one that I'm thinking right now is Benjamin Montgomery, who was a slave of the brother of Jefferson Davis, Davis of the president of the Confederacy. While his brother owned a plantation in the Mississippi River Delta, and Benjamin Montgomery, he trusted Benjamin Montgomery to run the plantation. Very unusual. And at the end of the Civil War, he gave Benjamin, another person, land which they developed into the all-black town of Mounds Bayou in the state of Mississippi. But he was a rarity. Again, most slaves were basically free wage workers. And their job was to learn how to live and work in a capitalist labor market. And the slaveholders, the ex-slaveholders, had to learn to become employers in the capitalist labor market. Now, the people, the Northerners, the victorious Northerners, especially those associated with the Freedmen's Bureau, and those who became, by 1866, 1867, the Radical Republicans, firmly believed in a free labor ideology, which underlied their principles or their guiding philosophy for them to institute their policies. And that was basically labor relations must be voluntary and it must be based on a contract. And so that's what ex-slaves and ex-slave holders had to learn to deal with. But ex-slaves had to put up with ex-slave holders who still thought in terms of slavery, namely compelling a workforce to remain immobile, to be fixed in place, to make sure that they have a supply of labor. And that, of course, did not sit well with ex-slaves. So what we have was a situation where ex-slaves or freed African-Americans engage in political and social and economic pushback. One of the things, for example, in the pushback was that many slaves, ex-slaves, had a desire to reestablish families, connections, those family members who were sold away, or at least establish a stable family life. Many slaves did have a family life, but it was always threatened by sale or some other activity thought of by the master. But after the Civil War, now they have a chance to have family life. And one of the things that happened in W.E.B. Du Bois, the African-American intellectual from the 1890s well into the 1950s, before he passed away in 1963, he wrote a book called Black Reconstruction, where he talked about the general strike. And that general strike was, well, like all good working people who could figure out the economics, if you tighten the labor supply, you can force wages to go up, force the employer to increase wages. At least that was the thinking. And how that manifested was that many black women who used to work in the fields when they were slaves, now upon freedom, many of them withdrew from the workforce to go into the home to take care of home, children, family, hearth, and things, activities in and around the home, like taking care of gardens or whatever, or doing laundry for other people. But that meant a significant portion of the workforce, women and children, were taken out of the fields. So one of the things that developed during the course of Reconstruction was, as I say, low-intensity guerrilla warfare between ex-slaves and ex-slave holders and their various allies, in the form of, well, ex-slave holders were keen on instituting the Black Codes, a form of laws, regulations, to govern, to tightly control black labor. And, of course, the issue was now, how can black people control their own labor power? Who will control black labor? And that was a big issue in the South. And the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations, similar to the Ku Klux Klan, that established themselves in the late 1860s, their job was, among other things, to suppress black labor, to put black labor back into a situation where white employers can control them. Now, as I mentioned much earlier, when I said Jeff Perry's discussion of the invention of the white race and how racism and race were invented, they were social constructs, using, of course, various facts from reality to create this social construct, similar things were reappearing. There had to be a new definition or a redefinition of racism and racial control. But as Perry pointed out, and as I will stress now and then, that the facade of that racism and race are deeply embedded in the politics and economics of American life, American institutions. And basically, race is interwoven into that fabric. If we take away racism, the economic and political institutions will stand out in stark relief for what they are, systems where working people do not have control over their work, or not enough control. Okay, well, so again, getting back to the major theme, how to teach ex-slaves and ex-slave holders to live in an open-ended capitalist economy. And once the system of slavery was destroyed and the southern slave-holding ruling class was destroyed as a class, or I should say transition into a class of employers, the South was wide open to capital investments, to industrial capitalism, which of course served the interests of northern industrialists. And in the background, because I say the background because they will come more to stark relief in the 20th century, but in the background, the people who ran the banking system, because they will be lending money to people, and they want their loans to be repaid, they want their credit to be repaid, and keep, but of course, on the other hand, the only way that they could keep people paying off the banks, paying off the people who own the plantation stores, or in various, or even in the north, in coal patch towns, company stores, same idea is working, keep people in debt, so they have to keep paying back. So that was in operation. And what ex-slaves wanted most of all was to become self-employed people. Since they were agriculturalists, what they wanted to do was to become land-owning farmers. That's where the 40 acres and a mule slogan became very popular. It was started mainly rumors, but there were some facts, a factual basis to it. When General Sherman was in control of the Sea Islands off the coast of South Carolina and Georgia, where land was distributed to ex-slaves, well, of course, that was taken away from them, but the idea caught hold and really animated many ex-slaves and some of their white allies. So the idea was, okay, 40 acres a mule, they'll be independent. But the problem was, not only was the nation further industrializing in textile industries, was in the forefront of industrialization, textile industries needed cotton. The United States government needed cotton for revenues, you know, for exports, imports, earning revenue that way. Many northern policymakers, let alone the ex-slave holders, wanted the ex-slaves who had the expertise and the knowledge to cultivate cotton to stay on the plantations and such. So we have a clash. And what emerged from that clash over time, let's say within a period of 3 to 6 years, varied in different places in the South, was a system of sharecropping. The ex-slaves and their families rent the land, rent their homes from the landowner, who was often the ex-slave holder. The ex-slaves will cultivate the land, and in return, they'll pay their rent to the landowner. Now, some people say in the beginning the landowner took in about one-third of the crop as rent. But in time, of course, abuse set in. So then in some cases, what the ex-slaveholders, the landowners, achieved in some cases was to put ex-slaves and their descendants into a situation of permanent debt, so to speak, because if people were lucky to break away, get away, they would do so. But the idea was to keep them in debt that peonage or just tied to the land. So this sharecropping system developed. Now, there was another system that was in development, the tenant farmer system. The big difference between tenant farming system and the sharecropping system was that basically all sharecroppers had was their labor power. Tenant farmers may have tools, they might have a horse or a mule, they may bring something into the relationship with the landowner. But all the those people became sharecroppers, all they had was their labor power for all practical purposes. And because they were paid in shares, not for the most part, not wages, because, well, again, money was tight. Credit was very tight in the South in the aftermath of the Civil War. And for all practical purposes, the South remained a economically sick or economically depressed, or America's equivalent to a developing nation up until the 1930s or 1940s. So that's a lot. So that background gives an idea how long things were to be played out as far as race, as far as black working people were concerned, well into the 20th century, especially in the southern states. So the reason why the majority of bureaucrats and politicians in the federal government did not go along with the idea of land confiscation of those treasonous slaveholders. Not all slaveholders were treasonous. Those who were in Maryland and Missouri and Kentucky and Delaware, those states, those slave labor states remain in the Union. Also Kentucky. I forgot about Kentucky. Well, maybe I mentioned Kentucky. But anyway, those folks, I can't call them treasonous because they stayed with the Union, but in the ex-Confederacy, where many slaveholders, ex-slaveholders, did commit treason, as far as the politicians and bureaucrats and other policymakers and those Northerners who want to make capital investments in the South, they did not want to engage in land confiscation or land distribution. So in some ways, the United States was teetering on a situation that numerous nations in Asia and Africa and Latin America experienced in the 20th century. Only those nations perhaps went further down the line to trying to do something about land distribution. But in the United States, it was practically nipped in the bud. And there were various reasons for that. Of course, some folks believed in the rights of private property. You just can't strip someone of his ownership of property. So there was property rights. Also, there are others who believed that the government, the federal government, which mushroomed during the Civil War, must return to a very limited form of government after the war. So, and engaging in land distribution and such would mean a federal bureaucracy would have to be set up to administer, to watch over this land distribution. And that would clash with the ideals, what people thought were the ideals of federalism, which was some type of balance. Of course, the Civil War may put that into question. What is the balance between the federal government and the state government? But at least the Civil War made it so that states cannot secede from the Union without paying some horrendous consequences. But despite that, some people in the government believed in federalism. And, of course, the policymakers, the investment people, they wanted some degree of a restoration of political and economic order in the South. Again, we have people running around, and black folks were not totally defenseless. They organized union leagues, which were, let's say, auxiliaries of the Republican Party. And in the South, black folks here and there and their white allies armed themselves, defended themselves. But the various white supremacist organizations and so forth had more firepower. So what the radical Republicans realized, they had to keep military forces in the South to break the resistance of these white supremacist organizations, which they did succeed. They passed, I believe, in 1872, the Ku Klux Klan Act, or I may be off by the name of it, but that law gave the government the chance to suppress the Ku Klux Klan, which the government succeeded in doing. But things were also moving in other directions. Ex-slaveholders and their allies were winning the dominance over the ex-slaves. They were redeeming the South for white rule, white supremacist rule. And of course, the whole idea, as Jeff Perry must have mentioned in his talk, that the ruling classes, the ruling elites, they have to have a buffer between the large mass of working people and themselves. And in the United States, racial differences, or what we call racial differences, whatever we want to call them, these phenotypes and such, were good markers to divide people and give. I don't like the idea of the term white privilege. I mean, a white worker really doesn't have privilege when we stop to think about it. But the white working people knew that maybe their chances of survival were better, or so they thought, by aligning with white employers, white plantation owners, and so forth, than with black working people. And I assume that's what Jeff Perry talked about as far as colonial America is concerned. So Reconstruction was, quite frankly, a very convoluted time, at least in the South, very convoluted time, where a new labor market was developing. And like I said, the white supremacists, or the white redeemers, they had a head start, because we have to remember, African Americans did not have citizenship until 1868 with the enactment or the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And of course, a few years earlier, they officially became free people with the ratification of the 13th Amendment. There's one little problem with the 13th Amendment. Yes, it abolished slavery, chattel slavery, but there's a clause in that amendment that said that involuntary servitude was okay when it comes to punishing people for crime or certain types of crime. Well, that's where, you know, our images of the chain gang and chain gang labor, prison labor, all that will be based on this, or will derive its inspiration from that little clause in the 13th Amendment. Black working people were arrested, detained for vagrancy. You know, think of all the black folks who were going up and down the roads and byways looking for missing family members that were missing because of slavery. If they don't have proof that they are employed somewhere, they'll be nabbed and be used as prison laborers. And so that would continue on. And in the South, they use prison labor, not only working in prison, but also working to build or repair roads and bridges and railroads, and or working on plantations, so on and so forth. So, in other words, building the infrastructure of the South, rebuilding it or whatever, expanding on it. Okay, I will leave Reconstruction in the South and go to Reconstruction in the North. Industrialization, of course, received a strong boost in the arm because of the Civil War. And after the Civil War, industrialization proceeded despite periodic what we now call recessions or depressions. But at that time, they were called panics. For good reason, I guess. But these economic downturns periodically broke the what was really an upward trajectory of a long period of economic boom, starting in the northern and midwestern states and continuing into other parts of the country. Now, with industrialization, working people in the north, there will be most industrial workers were white men mainly. A number of them were beginning to say, "We have to organize labor unions," and more than ever before, more so after the Civil War than before the Civil War, they held on to the idea. I mean, or they developed the idea of that organized labor must pursue collective bargaining rights, collective bargaining agreements, because it takes a number of workers to produce the wealth, to produce the commodities. So they have to work together at this. And among other things, they as a united group, they can counteract or they become a counterweight to the increasing economic power, political power, market dominance of industrial employers. And, of course, in time, the banking system, which was, again, as I said earlier, behind these employees. Okay, or not employees, behind these employers, excuse me. And so out of the wreckage of the Civil War, a number of workers, I believe around 200,000 in time between organized the National Labor Union, which was founded in 1866 and continued until it fell apart in 1873 or 1874 with the commencement of the Panic of 1873. The Panic of 1873, which was an economic depression that Americans at that time have never experienced the depth of an economic depression. That panic lasted until 1877. And I'll get to that important year of 1877 soon. Now, the National Labor Union collapsed because of that. But one thing about the National Labor Union, unfortunately, it did not accept black workers as members. So Isaac Myers, who was a ship calker, an African-American ship calker, in one of the shipyards in Baltimore, well, he also founded a cooperative of workers, the shipyard workers, black and white. He and others founded the Colored National Labor Union, which worked alongside with the National Labor Union before it too collapsed in the Panic of 1873. But although some people say racism, 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 I won't deny the existence of anti-black racism, but I think there was something more important there. Remember, African Americans did not have their citizenship rights. Rights to citizenship until 1868. And even though the Colored National Labor Union was founded in 1869, a year after the 14th Amendment, African American, the men, did not win the right to vote, a very key element in any country that, well, at least in the United States that professed to be democratic, a democratic republic, the vote is very important. And African American men did not have that right to vote until in ratification of the 15th Amendment in 1870. So, in a way, African American workers were, and African Americans generally, were on a nice trajectory to gain rights, to gain some degree of predictability in their economic lives as much as it can be predicted or stable in an unfettered capitalist economy.
Well, let's stay there for a minute.
Okay.
And we'll pick up part two another time. But you've said a lot today. You've given a lot of information. But what is impressive to me is that all along you are pointing to a very different narrative about slavery. And the word I wrote down was, it's a word being used quite a bit today, but pushback. Slaves were not these docile people without the means of articulating their own liberation. And you pointed to the insistence all along the way of finding some method by which to own their labor and the fruits thereof. This is very impressive to me.
Correct. And the idea was very much articulated during the Revolutionary War era. I mean, when you hear about and read Thomas Paine and the early Thomas Jefferson and others, when they talk, of course, we usually point to those words in the Declaration of Independence, inalienable rights, the rights to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, endowed by their creator that all men are created, meaning all people, but all men are created equal. All great words, and people knew what it meant and knew what the outcome would be. The question was how to translate it into reality. Many slaves even though many slaves before the Revolutionary War wanted freedom, now like most people in the Western world, they have a philosophical basis for saying why they want freedom, why people should be free, why you can't own another person. So for all practical purposes, the revolutionary ideals sounded the death knell of chattel slavery.
But isn't it ironic just to say that the North, the so-called liberal North, really was one of the most prolific sender points for slaves in the South? The North processed the slaves and sent them to the South. So we have this dichotomy that no matter whether people choose to believe the North was this liberal, the bastion of liberal thinking and great philosophy, and the South was just a bunch of plantation owners and hard, crude, racist owners of other people's labor. The fact is they were all pretty much involved in slavery as an economic endeavor, the North processing the vast majority of slaves.
Yes. The North was definitely complicit in the development of slavery and what became the United States, and in some ways continue to support slavery, especially the merchants of New York City who were into textiles, the textile industry, into insurance and such, right into the 1850s, perhaps into the Civil War itself. Correct. There's no argument from reasonable scholars who want to be reasonable about this. I just want to say that when you say liberal, we have to remember 18th century and 19th century Americans' perceptions of liberal or liberalism is different from what we think of liberal or liberalism. There, it's really anchored in the idea of individualism. Today, we feel that individuals could try to be equal, but with the help of a government. Back then, they were saying people can be free and equal without the help of a big government. Without the help of a federal government and so forth. If government's involved, it will be at the local level or the state level where people can have a hand in it. Now, complicating the process was that the idea of the ideal citizen was to be self-employed. Because if you're self-employed, so goes the argument. And remember, everything was on small scale at that time, human scale. But the thinking was, well, if you were self-employed, you'd be less likely to be bullied by someone who's rich or of economic means. Let's say if you were working for your wages and you want to vote for X, but your employer wants you to vote for Y, the employer will put pressure on you to vote for Y because you're economically dependent as a wage worker on the employer. Of course, this was before the secret ballot. The secret ballot became part of the American political landscape in the late 1880s. But before then, people knew whom you were going to vote for, and people saw whom you were going to vote for. And because of that thinking, many white working people could not vote. White working men. Women didn't get the right to vote until 1920. Although, curiously, women in New Jersey had the right to vote between 1883 and 1808. Why it was taken away from them, I don't know. I haven't done any reading or research in that area. But, okay. But this is all background, but very important because it does inform how people interacted with one another. Even though I know my students and others will say racism, 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 I don't deny that's not a problem. But there were white folks who were involved in helping black people. Even if they had racist ideas, they were helping black people who want to escape through the Underground Railroad, or hiring them, or helping them set up their businesses, or allowing them to attend various schools or colleges. Yes, very few in number, but there were whites of goodwill. And there were white folks who really believe in racial equality, racial egalitarianism. The famous white abolitionist John Brown is a good example of that. True, there wasn't a critical mass of such individuals, but which is why I guess we had the Civil War, but they were there. So it's hard to paint with broad brushstrokes. The devil is in the details. And yes, slaves push back in many ways. See, with wage work, the labor market, the pivot is that people work for money. People get paid
But whether in the South or in the North, this idea of white supremacy had by then become quite refined and basically all over the place. It was a national philosophy, it seemed, at that time. Could you talk about how it transitioned from the 1619 era to what was the thinking? How did this national thinking about white supremacy, black and everybody else is inferior, I should say, where was the nation with regard to this central philosophy?
Okay, well, the idea of race became an overlay on an older idea, namely some people are superior to other people because they were born into a particular social class, like royalty or aristocracy, or they happen to amass more wealth. So there was a hierarchy. I know when I talk to some students who came from places like Cambodia or some other country, they said that, well, they can recall that those people who have darker skin color because they work outside more than inside were looked down upon than those with lighter skin color. That would be true, I guess, for many countries or societies, that the rich, the powerful, they're not going to be out there in the fields working, or they're not going to be outdoors working, sweating bullets or whatever. They're going to be, you know, they'll be pursuing other things. So on that social hierarchy, we overlay race. Now, Jeff Perry, I didn't hear his talk, but I know from his other talks and from reading the books, The Invention of the White Race, that he pointed out how white and black working people, most of them were indentured servants because most black folks were not slaves until the 1650s or 1660s, definitely after the 1670s. But most black folks were not slaves but indentured servants. And yes, the word slavery was used as early as in the 1640s, but it applied to anyone. And we do have records written by indentured servants who described their indentured servitude as a form of slavery. And there were others who described indentured servants as slaves. Granted, indentured servants only work anywhere from 4 to 7 or 8 years unless the masters figure out a way to force the indentured servant to violate the rules of indentures and re-indentured the individual again. And that usually happens to women because masters will sexually exploit their women indentured servants, get them pregnant, hence breaking the rules of the indentures. But, okay, but what I'm saying is there was this camaraderie, sort of, I'll put that in quotation marks, but there was like an understanding among working people, especially in places like Virginia, Maryland. Okay, yeah, we're different and all that, but yet we share much in common. And when you look at the primary source documents of runaway indentured servants, black and white, sometimes they ran away together. And as Jeff Perry must have said about the Bacon's Rebellion, that was the clarion call for the elites to wake up and learn how to engage. I don't know how to say it in Latin, but it's divide and conquer, divide and rule, how to be more sophisticated at that. So that's when, after Bacon's Rebellion of 1676 in Virginia, more concerted effort was made to separate white working people from black working people legally, socially, so on and so forth. And of course, those who founded the colonies the colony of South Carolina, they came directly from the English West Indies, where slavery was already full blown. So they knew about slavery. And the other part of the United States that was French-speaking, Spanish-speaking, ruled by the French and the Spanish, Louisiana in particular, but up and down the Mississippi River Valley into Missouri and Illinois, their influence was also from the West Indies, where the French and the Spanish had their slave colonies. So, but of course, their slavery was structured in some ways with different perceptions than the Anglo form of slavery.
Well, Dr. Lumpkins, we'll have to leave it there for today.
Oh,
incredible!
I'm sorry,
but I will call you after the program, and we will reschedule. I should say we will schedule the other pieces to this incredible puzzle that you are unfolding for us today. So we'll expect a call right after the program. But thank you so much. And we will have to organize parts 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and 8, 9, and 10 right after this program. Thank you so much for this lecture today.
Thank you for your patience. I love history, and I just scratched the surface, but I should learn that I'm under time restraints, and I should do a better job at organizing myself.
No, you did very, very well. And our job is to accommodate the knowledge that you are so generously sharing with us today. So we'll do that right after the program. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it began to put in your minds how different a narrative there is to a subject that we think we know so much about. And, of course, the narrative that we've all been hearing is the same old, well, there's the helpless black people and they're slaves and they don't have very much else to offer the world, so there's a limit to what they can do. We're hearing an entirely different story here today, and we will build on it so that Dr. Lumpkins can fill out the rest of the lecture, and we will have healthy discussion and debate. But this, I think, should open your eyes about this question of black labor. And today, when you hear about the narrative that people are lazy, they don't want to work, and so forth, you see, when you look at things in context, you see what an extraordinary line of struggle that this particular question now arises in. You know, it's what are you talking about? when you know the context of things, it opens your eyes. I want to thank you so much for being with me today, and I certainly want to thank Dr. Lumpkins for beginning the process of explaining this idea of black labor. And as you heard in the narrative, it was about the value of the labor. He said, the value of the land, and second in value is the labor of the slave. That's enormous. Stay here at prn.fm, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with you, Trace Lead. Always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And we'll see you tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday, of course. Bye-bye.